I'm Sunny Kane, and you're listening to the next Faith-Filled Step right here on Pilgrim Radio. Each week, we'll explore simple, practical ways to respond to God's Word in our everyday lives. Let's choose wisdom over willpower, purpose over pressure, and take the next faith-filled step together. One day, one moment, one decision at a time. Well, friend, welcome back for another week on the next Faith-Filled Step. Looking forward to spending some time together with you. I'm not sure if you've ever walked through one of those seasons where it feels like you're kind of getting pummeled by the waves of life and you're buried underneath a weighted blanket. For me, I walked through a season where my daughter battled chronic illness. I mean, she still battles it today, but in the early days of this, it was really difficult because I couldn't rescue her from what she was standing in, and she would have all of these difficulties, and we didn't have any answers. And as a mother, I just wanted the pain to go away. I wanted her life to go back to what I thought was how it was supposed to be. And we grappled with God as we worked with doctors, and she never quite did get the healing that I hoped she would get. But I know He has been at work in her story. He's still at work today. And I'm sure you've been through something like this. It might not be your child. It could be for yourself, something that you have prayed for God, moments where it felt like your life has fallen apart or things aren't going the way that you had planned. And in these places, sometimes we wonder, is God still good? Even when it's all falling apart, even when He doesn't answer my prayers. Well, today's guest found himself in a season very similar. It spanned multiple years, and it was wave after wave that just kept hitting his family's life. And he found himself asking that very same question, is God still good, even when our world is falling apart? And I think you are going to find such encouragement from what he has to share today. His name is Bart Millard. He is the lead singer of Mercy Me. And his new movie, I Can Only Imagine 2, you might have already had the opportunity to watch. But we're here today to discuss his new book and seasons like these that sometimes leave us with more questions than answers. With that, here's my conversation with Bart Millard. All right. Well, Bart, I know we caught you in a busy season between a movie that just premiered, I Can Only Imagine 2, and a new book, Even If, that you co-authored with your wife, Shannon. We are incredibly grateful to have you taking your time to pour into our listeners today. Thanks for being with us on the next Faith-Filled Step.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd love for us to start here today. You know, there is this difference between knowing about God and knowing Him by name. And so I am curious, when it comes to the names of God or maybe the aspects of His character, what most resonates with you?
Oh, what day is it?
Yeah.
it changes constantly, but man, I mean, Abba Father is a big one for me. Just, you know, I'm the grown man with daddy issues, but gosh, I mean, provider, shelter. I mean, they all feel like they play a role in my life. But and just deliverer, the stuff He's gotten me through is astronomical, to say the least. And so it literally is, what day is it? Because it probably changes daily.
Yeah, or maybe three times a day, right?
Right. Yes.
Is one of the names of God right now just the season you find yourself in? I'm guessing you guys are a bit stretched with everything going on. Is there a certain name that has most resonated in this season?
I mean, right now, He's my shelter. You know, we're coming out of the craziness of promoting the movie, and we're on tour now, which, even though it's hectic, that's our safe space. Like, that's what we're used to doing. And so it just finding rest and getting to the, you know, by the time we get to May, you know, being able to spend quality time with my family and just kind of get off the radar. But yeah, he's been my shelter this season. Yeah. Just any chance I can get is just, you know, I'm very protective of my time at home, and just and ironically, just being on the road with my four best friends after doing the whole movie thing kind of on my own has been a great, it's a familiar place to be. So I'm really enjoying this tour.
Well, I know today we're here to talk about your new book, Even If, and about a season of your life that you said everything was going so well and you were living what felt like the abundant life at the height of success. And then you share that you were blindsided when everything changed with your journey taking a turn that you never saw coming. Would you talk to our listeners a little bit about that season?
Yeah, I always say there's life before 2004 and life after for us. It was, that was the year that everything changed for us. We were going through the height of imagined success with Christian and mainstream radio, and it was more than we ever thought possible. And gosh, I guess it started January 4th of 04. My brother-in-law was killed in a car accident, fell asleep at the wheel after an all-nighter of... He got his heart broken. He was at our house. He hadn't slept for 48 hours or more, and just was kind of manic, like he was just wanted to know that God was real and why did she do this, and he was all over the place. And by 5-6 in the morning, I can't remember what time, we were getting nowhere, and out of frustration, there's one rule in my house is that you never disrespect Shannon. He kind of got disrespectful to her, and it frustrated me. And I was like, resorted back to something my dad would have said, where he's like, man, it just sounds like somebody needs to take you out back and knock some sense into you because you're talking crazy. And he took it literally. And I was like, no, we've lost our minds. We're so tired. Let's just get some rest and we'll talk a little bit later. And he got up and was like, and Sam, my oldest son, was about to turn three, I think. And so he was like, tell Sam I love him. And he left. And it was a few hours. Shannon was like, that wasn't right. I need to go try to find him. And by the time I did, I couldn't find him. I came home. And then a few hours later, my father-in-law called and said that he had fallen asleep at the wheel and just run off the road. And from what they could tell, his MO was to do something like that and come back and apologize or whatever. And they said it looks like he was on his way back to your house because we lived in the country. And he just missed a hard curve. And he could barely keep his eyes open when he's at our house, mm-hmm. and we really tried to get him to stay. So that happens in the beginning of 04. A month later, my uncle, who was like my second father and my hero, just dropped dead of a brain aneurysm while we were on the Undone tour, a month to the day of when Chris died. And then we found out we were pregnant with our second, and Gracie came like 7 weeks premature in November. And the day we brought her home was the day that we found out that something was wrong with Sam. And so we took him to the hospital and found out he had type 1 diabetes and didn't know it then, but that would be the thing that would eat at me for the next 20 years or still to this day. Like to lose someone is incredibly hard, and time helps you heal from that eventually. But when you deal with someone with a chronic illness and you're reminded every day, every time he puts food in his mouth, or Sam's 24 and he's easily had over 60,000 shots in his lifetime, and it's that thing that never lets up. And so it's just a grind, and I think it did more damage than I realized, and then after that, and that was in November, in December my father-in-law, the godliest man I've ever known, they found a grapefruit sized tumor in his brain and made us say our goodbye, saying that there's a less than 50% chance that if he does survive at all, he won't be the same. And so we went through that turmoil of letting him go. And thank God he came out perfectly fine. In fact, this was 04. He just passed away of leukemia about a year and a half ago. And so he's at 82 or 83. So he's had an incredible life. But the trauma of everything went through, assumed this is it. Like, why would we have any kind of hope right now? And so that year was, that put me into all of it, I guess. I went into a state of depression from the year Sam was 2 to when he's about 15 or probably 15. I was not present. I was in a bad, bad way. If I ever went back and looked at all the songs during that season, I'm sure that they're all, it kind of chronicles from songs like The Hurt and the Healer. There's so many that was me fighting through this depression and trying to find the hope. So it was... it changed everything, and it wasn't until a dear friend of mine came into my life and somehow showed me my identity in Christ and what grace was and just kind of took the burden off me, because that depression was that it happened on my watch. I think a lot of fathers, a lot of parents wrestle with, like, is it something that I did wrong? Is it, you know, I could have done something differently. You know, it's, and you kind of hold that guilt, and, you know, you do anything to fix your kid. And the second you know that you can't, it's devastating. And I didn't see it coming. You know, I can't even describe to that feeling until I went through it. And so it was a hard, hard season. And I'm grateful I'm past it now.
Yeah. And seasons like those where it feels like we're getting pummeled by the waves. I'm guessing people listening right now, while they might not have the exact nature of the things that you described, I think that we have these seasons, these wilderness seasons in our lives, sure, where thing after thing happens. And my heart goes out to you with a kid with chronic illness. That is our story too. And it's a hard place to describe all the places you go with God in that, all of the agony that you feel within when God doesn't rescue or heal your child from what you can see. So I want to thank you for just opening up your story and the tenderness of these moments, because it connects with people like me, like people listening who have been through this. Now, you talk about Psalm 23 and how everyone loves the promise of green pastures and quiet waters, but that there's no guarantee we won't experience walking through the valley of the shadow of death. And then this really resonated. You said, as humans, in our desperate desire for self-preservation at all costs, we tend to only want to accept the good and the blessed from God, never the bad and the broken. Why do you think we do this, even though Jesus told us in John 16:33 that in this world we would have trouble?
That's a great question. I don't know. You know, we wrote a song, one of the first songs I wrote when Sam was diagnosed, a song called Bring the Rain. And the whole idea of the song is, man, give me all the good things, but if you're telling me that the only way I get closer to you is through the suffering, then bring the rain too. Like, I my desire is to know you more and to cling to you. You know, I love when people go, God will never give you more than you can handle. Of course he will.
Yes,
the goal is for us to cling to him, to rely on him, and no, make no mistake about it. Like, no misunderstanding of, well, yeah, I could handle this one. This was on me. No, I don't believe that. And so I think nobody wants to, I was going to say about Bring the Rain, there was a station in Houston that refused to play the song, and they were like, we don't agree with the theology of that. You're asking God to break you. You're asking for this turmoil in life and then asking him to deliver you from it once you ask for it. I remember getting so upset about it. I should send them flowers because it made me get in the word more than I ever had before. But there was, and I was like, man, ask Job about that. Ask the parent with the blind child, or the whatever it is. Ask them if it's wrong to ask God to, if you bring this on, if this is what it takes to get close to you, then let me, I'll take it. I was like, it was just a crazy thought for me. And so as far as I've been alive, nobody wants to wish suffering into their life, but I think Paul talks about, like, suffering, treating it like it's a gift. And it really is. I mean, you know, I know as a kid, I vividly remember all the times that I dang near killed myself as a child, whether I tried to jump the ramp that was too tall, where I'd come in eyes wide open and breathing heavy. And my dad's like, oh, Lord, what have you done? I'll never forget those moments. I don't remember all the great moments that so much, but I remember the times where I almost killed myself and there was some lesson learned in that. And it's like, there's something about suffering. Like, I'm sure you can relate. I can meet somebody that's kind of this holier than thou, that's never hit rock bottom. And it's like, there's this self-righteous thing about them that just turns me off. And then I can meet someone that the bottom has fallen out, that they've lost everything. And that's what I meant about finding identity and grace and it applying to your life. It's like those people that have been through those seasons of suffering are different, man, and the kind of people I want to be with. They've seen the worst, and they become so incredibly grateful. And the gospel and Jesus comes to life even more so. It's, I don't know how to explain it, but it's just, it's different. And yeah, so it's like, I don't know, we avoid it at all costs. Nobody wants to suffer, but it's such a vital part of our lives. It's there whether we like it or not. You know, I say it every night, like, I don't have to know you personally to know we all have hurt and pain in common. And if you don't, God bless you, it's coming. But yeah, that's the one thing we can relate to. And it's done nothing. For whatever reason, I'm the guy that never ran from him. I just tried to hold on as tightly as I could. It doesn't mean that I wasn't depressed and went through hard seasons, but I never gave up on believing that there was hope in Jesus. And yeah, there's about 10 or 12 years of desperation in the songs that I was writing, just trying to pull myself out of a hole. And people are like, well, does that mean you're insincere? I was like, no, it was wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. Like most of those songs are what I long to be more than anything. And nothing's really changed today. I'm still that person that everything that I write, of course I want to be that person, but it doesn't, even I can only imagine if people knew when I actually wrote that, started writing it, or the idea came about, I was leaving my dad's gravesite. My grandmother was like, I can only imagine what your dad's seeing now. I was 19 when he passed away. And somebody else said, you know, if he could choose, he would choose heaven than he would here. And I appreciate the sentiment. That's the worst thing you can tell a 19-year-old who just lost his dad. And so those questions in the chorus originally were me like, all right, God, what's so great about you that he would want you over me? Like, it wasn't I'm a super Christian. It was like, explain this to me, because that makes zero sense why he would choose you over me. Now, when I actually sat down and wrote the song, which was in 99, 8 years later, I was on board. I understood what I was writing at that point, but it took a while for me to process and to, you know, to make sense of it all. And so most of my life is wishful thinking.
Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful that for people like you, you know, whether you have a book or whether you have, a song that you've heard, when somebody is writing out of the genuine suffering that they're walking through, the honest groanings of a heart, I think that's why songs and books land in such a way, because they're speaking the language, not in past tense, like, I'm present with you in this right now, and I know the agony that you are carrying. And that takes a level of courage and faith to live out loud in the way that you have. So I'm grateful that you have. Now, here's a belief that you share about that I think a lot of people can relate to it. You said you've talked about how your past wired you to feel like you were responsible for anything bad that happened around you. Can you talk to us a bit about how that belief played out in your life, and how would you encourage someone else who might be carrying that same broken belief?
You know, I grew up in an abusive relationship with my father until, you know, he was diagnosed with cancer when I was in high school, and Jesus changed him, like completely changed him to where he's my best friend by the time he passed away. But before that, in your formative years, I was reacting probably the way a pet would. Like, it was, if I do X, Y, and Z, I get rewarded, or if I'm punished, it was something that was obviously my fault. And it took a long time and a lot of therapy as an adult to realize, oh wait, that wasn't my fault. But yes, it's something that I wrestle with daily. Of like, you know, no lie, I wish I was kidding, but we could be getting fast food in a drive-thru, and my kid wants a burger with no onions, and there's onions on it. I feel like that was on me to this day. Like, I think I said it earlier, but it happened on my watch. I carry that burden, whether it's a fast food order or my son with diabetes. It's been something I've had to work on. And I have good days and bad days. I wish I could say I'm over it, I'm good now, but no. It just depends where I am. And there's some days, you know, where it's still, you know, if Sam's having a rough time or just anything with our family, I can go back. In the movie, well, and I think in the book it talks about we had this flower chair in the corner of our living room. I would always go sit in that chair when I was depressed, and my kids would climb on me. I would never even notice. I was not present at all. I was zoned out. And it was such a big part of our lives that to this day, my wife would be like, are you going back to the flower chair right now? Like, that chair's long gone, thank goodness. But
real quickly, does the flower chair, is it representing depression there, or is it emotional withdrawal? Like, how, when she asks you that question, what does she mean by that?
All of the above. Okay. It's just, that's emotional withdrawal. Because of depression, there was emotional withdrawal to where I would just, and I have ADHD, so that's a whole different thing. But there'd be things that feel insurmountable to me that, you know, even if it's like taking out the trash sometimes, there's things in these moments where I'm like, I'm paralyzed, I can't move. And so I would always retreat to the flower chair. Now, during those years of depression, I would go on the road, do shows, I would come home. I would go to bed, I would wake up late, and I would literally be in that chair most of the day. And my kids, who thought they were playing with me, were just climbing on me like I wasn't present. And that was for years. It was really, really hard, and got up to like 370 pounds. And it was just, it was, everything was a little out of control. And so it represents a little bit of all of that.
Yeah.
And so if my wife sees me, you know, I tend to get really quiet when I'm struggling. And she's like, are we in the flower chair? Like she said it to me 3 days ago. So it's still, you know, it's something I'm grateful for now because it kind of pulls me out of that. But yeah, it's, you know, it took therapy to kind of connect my childhood. But yes, I do. I take the burden on myself, no matter what it is, when something's not right, when we're not in sync as a family. Like I feel like I dropped the ball somehow, and it's something I've had to let go of. And some days I nail it and some days I don't.
Do you feel like that's something a lot of men and fathers wrestle with?
My experience is yes. Yeah, I think I don't know how many healthy father-son relationships are out there. I'm sure there are some, but a lot of people that I've met are like, man, my dad didn't say much. He would just put me in line if I was out of line. And it's a very, you know, maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know, but it's a very much like you do it right. Great. If you do it wrong, we're going to set you straight, whatever that looks like. And you do that enough, like a pet, they're going to respond exactly the way you want them to.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one of the coolest and craziest things as a parent that I learned was when we started grief counseling. Basically, I used to say for Chris, but all of 2004, we eventually went to grief counseling, which was the beginning process of getting me out of this funk. And that was probably, I don't know when it started, but in that, I was joking one day because I have five kids. And at that point, you know, if one of my kids went to spend the night with the family, with friends, they'd be like, man, your kids are incredible. They're angels, the best behaved, awesome, whatever. And I'm like, really? Because they are jerks at home. Like, I'm like, how is that? Because they would come home and just be the devil sometimes. And I used to joke about like, man, something, they've got y'all hoodwinked because these kids are out of control. And I jokingly said it in counseling. And the counselor was like, you know, actually, she goes, that's a really good sign because what's happening, these kids have to work through all these emotions somehow. They have to, especially when hormones kick in, like they're going to practice what angry and what jealousy and what anxiety, they've got to work that out. And she goes, and this was very foreign to me because it's not the way I grew up. She goes, you've created an environment to where they trust that you will never walk out on them so much so that they can get in the car and just unload. And and she goes, part of that is there is a trust there that you're going to see a terrible side of me, them trying to work it out because they believe I'm safe and you're not going anywhere. And I remember being in tears because I was like, I don't know what that's like because that was not my childhood. And so I never acted out until I was with my friends or whatever. And maybe it's a little bit the opposite. It's like I couldn't act out at home. I acted out with the neighbors. I don't know, but it was different for me. And so I'm like, wait a minute, let me get this straight. I need to pat myself on the back because I'm a good parent because my kids are jerks at home. And she goes, kind of. Like, if they're acting amazing out there, they have it under control, but they need a place to work through all these emotions. Mm-hmm. And so it changed my perspective. But I think there's a lot of dads, a lot of men out there that may be able to relate with how my upbringing was, whether it's generational or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know, we weren't given the room to act out, if you will.
Yeah.
Most of us. And so I think there are a lot of men that could relate. Yeah. I think
think so too. And I mean, I can relate, and I'm not a dude, but I would say, mm-hmm, I see my husband carry that a little bit differently. You know, so now there was a time that all of this season, it began to shift. You mentioned grief counseling, and clearly that is a big journey. It's not like something that shifted overnight, but you eventually came to the place where you could rest in Christ and your identity in Him. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I would say probably 2015-ish, it's probably 2012, actually. A dear friend of mine, it was the first church camp we ever did years before, like in the early 90s. His name's Rusty. In fact, my son Sam is married to his daughter now, but he's one of my best friends, and he was a Baptist youth pastor. I remember him, you know, he was all in, like would do the true love weight stuff and all of this, everything that you were taught to do. And he had a parent that came to him, a dad that said, hey, especially on the, I don't know if you're familiar with the True Love Waits, you remember all that stuff. I don't know if you do or not, but okay. Well, back then, this dad had daughters in the youth group, and he goes, hey, man, let me know when you're done with this little campaign. I'll let my kids come back to church. And he was like, what are you talking about, dude? This is a good thing. He goes, no. He goes, this is legalism at its finest. He goes, if you tell kids to stay off the lawn long enough, they're going to want to step on the lawn. And he goes, why are you focusing on don't do this till you're married. Don't do this till married. And oddly enough, he did have more situations of kids getting into trouble during that season. But anyway, but this set Rusty, my buddy, off. He was like, that conversation ended up, they ended up talking weekly about, what are you talking about? Like legalism. He goes, man, you've got to rest in grace. You've got to rest in the fact that the finished work of the cross was enough. Like you're doing all of these things. You're trying to make God happy. Like you're trying to get approval, make sure he's pleased. And he was like, what if he's already pleased? What if on your worst possible day, your worst day ever, where everything's out of control, he still looked at you as holy? And Rusty went through this transformation, and then he ended up coming out on the road with us once, and he was telling me this stuff, and I was like, hold on, like, what are you saying? This is like discovering fire. I don't even understand the words that are coming out of your mouth. And he was like, he goes, think about it. He goes, man, he goes, you work so hard. And he knew me better than anybody. He still does. He's like, you're writing these songs, you're doing all this stuff in the height of your depression, you're doing all this stuff as if, if you do it enough, God will be like, all right, you're good. Mm-hmm. We're good. And trying to please him, although I would never say it was works. I was trying to earn something, but it absolutely was. And he was like, man, he goes, what if you never lifted another finger? And from this point on, and you understood that Jesus still was like, I couldn't be more pleased with you. Mm-hmm. And I'm crazy about you. Whether you ever do another single thing. And I was like, this does not, you're speaking a different language. I don't understand this. And he was like, this is what true rest is. He goes, that there's nothing you can do right now, nothing amazingly well or terribly awful that you could do to make Jesus love you any more than he already does right now. And you need to accept that. And he just started pouring over scripture on me daily, of just all the scripture to back up who we are in Christ and what we mean to him. And it was like being in a desert and needing water so badly that it just ignited something to where I think the band was a little nervous because it turned everything upside down. I was so, in fact, it's the album that had come out, The Hurt and the Healer, when this all started happening. And then we released the album called Welcome to the New. And that was the beginning of this new identity and grace message, which hasn't changed since then. But that was, it was a massive transformation. That's the thing that pulled me out of my depression and just realize, oh, this is not all on my shoulders. And just the mere thought that there's a God that, you know, talking about Abba Father, that has seen me at my absolute worst and goes, gosh, I'm still crazy about you, still blows my mind to this day.
Yeah. Man, thanks for sharing that. I want to honor your time. With your permission, can I ask you one more question, or would you like us? Okay.
Yeah.
So I just, because the book title is Even If, we know you have a song title of the same name. And I know that that song was born during one of the hardest parts of the journey. And so I would just love, knowing that there are listeners right now who know that God can heal, and they know that he has the power to save, and yet they are living in the ache of the even if because he hasn't done what they have been praying for. For that person who is struggling to trust God when the healing hasn't come and those waves keep crashing, what is one faith-filled step that you would encourage them to take?
Man, I think there's something about changing our mindset. Like the enemy attacks us between the ears. It's about our thoughts. And if he takes our thoughts hostage, we're in trouble because he can't touch the heart, man. We're good there. But the enemy will always try to isolate you and think that no one could ever understand what you're going through. You know, you talking about having a child with a chronic illness, you know, the voice that I wrestle with is the voice that says, well, don't complain too much. It could be worse. It could always be worse. And so we end up, you know, like, I mean, I remember telling Lionsgate, diabetes is the most underwhelming disease out there because it could be worse. And there's people that can relate to that, whether it's diabetes or not. And we had so many come up when they saw the movie going, I felt like I was heard for a second, because so many people want to scream in their car when they're alone, or they want to call it quits, but they get up every day and do it again. And the enemy will try to make you think no one can relate. Why bother? And I'll tell you, I learned to change my mindset. So when Sam was diagnosed back then, you had to stay in the hospital for like a week. Now it's like less than, it's not even overnight hardly, but they had to make sure the insulin would take and all this stuff. And so we were supposed to do the Billy Graham Crusade at the Rose Bowl that weekend. And I was living in Dallas, outside of Dallas. And I was obviously, I couldn't go. And the guys had already gone ahead to set up. It's a big production, big thing. And I said, man, I know you guys are out there, but I can't do this. And they understood. And so I get a message back, and it was from Billy Graham's camp. And they were like, hey, Dr. Graham just wants to know, can he send a plane to pick you up, fly you to the Rose Bowl so he can pray for Sam? You don't have to sing. You can get back on the plane and go right back home. And I was like, what? And we had so much family. My wife was like, you have to do this. He goes, we'll pick you up at noon. We'll have you back by midnight. So my wife's like, you've got to do this. And so I get on this private plane, fly to Pasadena, and police escort to the stadium. The guys are already there, but and they had gone through sound check, but they were like, you don't have to do anything. And so, and there's a point to this. So we go, and there's this massive stage. The place is packed. And there's a tent on both sides of the stage, and there's all this media and security. It's packed on one side, and the other side is completely empty. Well, they walk us to the empty side, and I'm getting a little worked up because I thought they got it wrong, and Dr. Graham's over there. I'm like, I flew all this way. No, no, this is because it's about to all start. And I'm looking over there like, you're kidding me. We've come this far. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice say, you know, sometimes you kind of need to let the, it's okay to not let the left hand know what the right hand's doing. He kind of laughed, and it's just us and him. Like, they've created this diversion so he could have a few minutes with us. And I'm sitting there, and he looked at me, he goes, Bart, I'm so sorry about your son, Sam. And the second he said my son's name, I just lost it. And he goes, is it okay if I pray for him? I'm like, man, that's why I'm here, dude. So he put his hand around the back of my neck, and I'll never forget what he prayed that changed my perspective. And this is what I mean by the mindset. Yeah. You know, it's one thing to lose a loved one and grieve over that and heal over time. The chronic illness is different. And I'll never forget, he said, God, we believe with all of our heart that you can heal Sam immediately. There's no question. But if you choose otherwise, then he kind of stopped and kind of chuckled and said, then Sam's just going to change the world as a diabetic. And I lost it, and I was like, and I realized at that point, this is just the new normal. It's not living my life in the midst of tragedy and grief for the rest of my life. This is just the new normal. And so that's been our theme in our home, is that, you know, my middle son, Charlie, has a stuttering problem, and we don't say, then Charlie, I guess you're changing the world with a stutter. Yeah. Sam, you're changing the world as a diabetic, and you have to change your mindset. And because it's not just to say, even if you don't like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it's not like to say, even if you don't, as if it's just not going to be healed. It doesn't end there. It's almost like in saying that is, God, what are you about to show me that was worth not healing him? Like, what is he about to do? What's about to happen that is so much greater and more beautiful than, we joke all the time, we'll play at a baseball game and we'll do the first pitch. We've done so many, we hate doing them. So if you ever Google Bart throws lefty, the band dared me to throw left-handed. It looks like I had a stroke. It's the worst thing you've ever seen. And people are like, I can't believe you did that. It's still on, and like, it's so embarrassing. I was like, well, wait a minute. If I had thrown normal, no one would be talking about it. But because of me doing this, we're still laughing at it. And I've kind of imposed it on my kids. Like, man, yeah, you could have been just the healthy, normal kid. But for whatever reason, God has chosen something incredible for you. And I cannot wait to see it unfold. And it is unfolding. And so it's just changing your mindset and your perspective, is that, you know, God didn't turn his back on you. I want to believe he's sitting there going, no, watch this. Yeah. Like, watch what's about to happen. And so, sorry, that was a long way to get
no,
to the answer.
No, and I, yeah. you've actually invited us to lean in with anticipation instead of anxiety. You know how often we're waiting for God to, for the other shoe to drop after seasons these. And instead you're saying, what might God be doing? And so thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, for taking time out of your week. We are more than honored, and I guarantee you, you added value to our listeners. So bless you, Bart, and your family in the days ahead.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, to our friends who are listening, thanks for being here for another week on the Next Faith-Filled Step. Our guest today has been the lead singer of Mercy Me, Bart Millard. We've been discussing his new movie, I Can Only Imagine 2, as well as his book that he co-authored with his lovely wife, Shannon. It's called Even If, Trusting God Through the Fire. And I'd encourage you to pick that up today. And I also want to encourage you to share this episode with a friend. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify. You can locate us on the Pilgrim Radio app. But this episode might be for your friend who is wondering, is God still good, even when their world is falling apart? Bart's story is one of redemption, and it points to the goodness of God. And that just might be the encouragement that the person who's on your heart is needing. Well, thanks for listening to the Next Faith-Filled Step right here on Pilgrim Radio. This week, look for one way to respond to what God is revealing in your life. One day, one moment, one decision at a time.